Good morning, everybody. Welcome in. It is a pleasure to be learning today, and thank you for coming. Despite the lack of coffee, despite the fact that it's a fast day, we're going to start the opportunity to learn together. We're starting a new series. The series is called A Study of Sieges, and I thought that being as today is Shavasa B'Tammuz, and we're starting this period of the 3 weeks, we'll look at a number of sieges in Jewish history, and not just the history part of it, but the we'll call halacha and machshava components of them. There's a number of them, some successful for our side, some unsuccessful on our side. It'll be fascinating to trace them through history. So let's start at the very beginning. Our travels take us to Israel and Jericho, Yisrael and Yericho today, and we thank the sponsorship this morning for hopefully the speedy finding and refuah of Chaim ben Shara and Malka by Sarah Rachel and all of the others who are unfortunately still missing in Surfside in Miami. Be'ezras Hashem, we should know only Besaras Tavos, so we should be able to find them miraculously, God willing. Let's start learning today. So our first siege that we're going to focus on is really the first siege that Israel really experiences, and this is to be found in Yoshua Perek Vav. It's the siege of Jericho. And we have only one perek in Tanakh which really officially deals with this. It is a fascinating topic in and of itself. Let's understand some of the aspects of this, what makes this unique and special. And it has some fascinating reverberations for later history as well. Not going to learn the whole perek inside, just because it is a long perek, but a few salient details. So let's start at the very beginning. We'll look at Pesukim Aleph to Vav. We're told the following: V'yirichoy sogeres umusogeres mipnei bnei Yisrael ein yosei ve'ein ba. So Jericho is shut up. It's locked up in front of Israel. There's no one entering. There's no one exiting. Hashem tells Yoshua, I'm going to give the city to you. Remember, Yoshua already has sent spies to Jericho just a few prokim prior. And so there's debate as to the timing of this, how this relates. But nonetheless, they've sent spies. Yericho knows that Israel's sights are upon Yericho. And Hashem now promises Yoshua to give it to him. So he says, what you're going to do is you're going to surround the city or circuit the city 6 days. And you're going to do the same thing. And on every day, there's going to be seven priests, seven Kohanim, with seven horns. And they're in front of the Aaron. And on the seventh day, they're going to circuit the city 7 times, at which point the Kohanim will blow the shofros. And when they hear the horn blowing, it sounds like the Yovel, kind of, as is described in Parshas Bahar. Everybody should raise their voices and cry out. And then they're able to access the city itself, and that's what Yoshua does. In the next few psukim, he goes on to tell the Kohanim, and he goes on to tell the people, this is what we're going to do. He gives the instructions, and we hear the instructions are followed out all the way through Pesach Pasuk Tes Zion. So miraculously, they circle the city 7 times, once per day, 7 times on the seventh day. That pattern should sound familiar in Halacha. Where else do we see that pattern? That's the pattern of Akofos, right? The pattern of Akofos, Hoshanos, of circling the Mizbeach. Later on, is patterned after this. And the walls fall down, and they conquer the city. At which point, Yoshua actually adds an extra addendum in Pasuk Yud Zayin, where he adds something which Hashem did not tell him. Here's what he says. Vayzair Cherem. The city should be a Cherem. The way they translate it over here in the JPS translation is devoted. Cherem is a very unusual word. It can, on the one hand, mean Hektesh, something dedicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, on the other hand, it could mean something destroyed, not touchable. So the city should be set aside. He v'kol asher bo Hashem, to God. Rak rachav azonot techia. He v'kol asher ito b'bayis ki hechbeisa es amalachim asher shalachnu. So he says, and you need to spare rachav azonot because she was the one who hid our spies at threat to her knife. Rak atem shimru emin acherim, but you yourselves should guard yourselves from anything which is in the city. Pen tacharimu, lest you be destroyed. Ulakachtim min acherim, when you take from it. V'samtim es machane Yisrael lecherim v'achartem osan. You'll make Israel cursed by taking from the cherim. So it's to be dedicated to Hashem and destroyed. If you take it, you're going to be destroyed because essentially you're taking something which is destroyed or devoted into your own house. Everything which is gold, silver will belong to the treasury of Hashem. Vayara ha'am v'yisukuba shofroiz v'yikishmo ha'am es kol ha'shofar v'yiru ha'am trua gedola v'yitipol ha'choma tachta v'yal ha'am ha'ira ish negda v'yukadu es ha'ir. And then war ensues afterwards. The city is conquered. V'yacharimu es kol ha'shebo'ir me'ish adisha minar v'ad zalken v'ad shor seh chaveseh ha'mor l'fichereb. Everything is destroyed. They can kill all living souls in the city. Yushnaim anashim amiraglim es ha'aretz. Omar Yoshua Bo based on Yeshua Zonova, Tzil Misham is a Yeshua Veskola Sherloka Sher Nishbatem. Yeshua sends ahead the two spies to help bring Rachav and whoever's in a house or an apartment out. Vayavo and Arima Meraglim, Vayotzu is Rachav Vesavio Vesema, Vesachel Veskola Sherlo, Veskola Mishbechoisel, Vayotzil Vayanichum, Vayan Nichum Michutzlamachan Israel, and he places them outside the camp of Israel. Vayirus. So refu ba'esh v'kol ha'shebo, rakes v'azov v'klei nechosh v'zav v'arizel, not snu l'oitzar b'ez Hashem. So here's the dual meaning of the word cherem. So on the one hand, all the valuables are taken to the coffers of the treasury of Hashem, Mishkan, future Migdash, but the rest of it is burnt down. So everything is destroyed, all furniture is destroyed, nothing is left. And in Pasuk Chavav, now Yeshua does something which is rather extraordinary. V'yashaba Yeshua bo'esh le'ilemor, Aru ra'ish lifnei Hashem asher yakum ubana esair azois es yirichoi bivchara yiyastena uvitzira yatziv delaseha, that anybody who rebuilds the city will be cursed. When they put the foundations, when they pour the cement for the foundations, they will lose their firstborn. When they finish the doors, that's the last part of the city, they will lose their last child. That's the curse Yoshua puts on his yirichoi. So all over, this is a very unusual siege in so many different ways. It is miraculous, number one, but it's also semi-miraculous, meaning to say there's still a war which happens, right? The walls fall down, they still have to conquer them. It just happens to be that they no longer have their defenses. So we'll call it a semi-miraculous victory. Now, then we also have this cherem, which Yoshua places, and we can ask ourselves, did Hashem command this? Did Yoshua command this? Did Hashem agree with this? Was it the right thing to do? And then we have this Shavua at the end where Yeshua not only describes there's a cherem, the city's destroyed, but he actually proclaims there's no future building of the city. So all these pieces come together to create a very unusual picture for us. Let's try to understand this. It is interesting to note that there are those who claim that Yericho is the oldest city in the world. So the archaeological evidence goes back many thousands of years. And there are those who argue that Yericho, in fact, is one of the oldest cities in the world. But why is it so crucial? Why is it so important? So the first thing that we should notice is this is the first conquest in Israel. Israel have, yes, conquered, we'll call it East Bank Israel, which is the area where Sihon and Og were, which were two Amorite kings. But in the end of the day, that wasn't considered, we'll call it Israel proper yet. This is the first time they go across the Jordan. They're in an area by the banks called Gilgal. This is their first real conquest in the land of Israel. So it comes with a certain degree of gravitas. We have to understand why that is. So first thing to be clear is, you know, why is Yericho so important? So the Pasuk describes to us one aspect about it. So the Pasuk says it's sogeres umesogeres, right? It is closed and completely locked up, inaccessible. So that could be a description of its fortifications. In fact, that based on the archaeological evidence, it's fascinating that there were actually two rings of walls. As just if you take a look at the picture at the bottom of the page over here, there were two rings of walls, the inner wall and the outer wall of Yericho. So it was a strongly fortified city. So it could be a description of the city itself. However, the Tanhuma tells us that there's a little more to it than that. If you take a look at the first source, the source one, it says, Amar Rabbi Yishmuel Bar Nachman, Yericho Sogeres Shel Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't just a fortified city, it was the aperture of access to the rest of Israel. Amru ma im nichbasha Yericho miyad kol aretz nichbeshes levirach nis kan su lesaicha shiva umos. If Jericho would fall, the rest of Israel would very soon thereafterwards fall as well. So that's why they sent their seven nations there. What does that mean? They sent the seven nations. The Midrash goes on to elaborate that they had representatives, military support from all the different nations, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite, all sent their representatives to Jericho because they realized it was their buffer. Interestingly enough, there's a number of tiers of buffers. So if you remember, in the end of Parshas Chukas, when Sichon, was fighting against Israel. Part of the reason why you're so aggressive, meaning like if you think about the dialogue, it kind of went like this. Israel says, can we please come across your land? And he walks out with his army to attack us. You know, so that kind of dialogue is not a very healthy. So why was Sichon so aggressive? So the Mefarshim explained is because Sichon had the responsibility of being the buffer zone from any attacks from the east, which is precisely his job, right? So he was employed by, he received taxes from we'll call Canaanite nations in Israel to protect them. So that's why he was so aggressive when somebody tried to come through his land. What is interesting is the same kind of thing with Jericho. Jericho is seen as the key access. Take a look at a map. Just I put a map here on the page just below it. So you can see there's the Dead Sea. And essentially the first city north of the Dead Sea is Jericho. But if you look at the topographical map to the left, it's hard to see because it's just in black and white here. But Jericho is that little dot. You can see it's essentially by the coastal plain. The coastal plain of the river, which is where it's lower. And it's the access essentially to the mountains. Right, it's the access to the mountain range leading into the mountains of Samaria, Judea and Samaria. So that means to say that it is, we'll call it our access point, which is necessary. That's why it was so fortified, because it was a ir sapar. It was a border city, which has more consequence to it as well. So when understanding the, we'll call it military significance, it is obviously comes with a great amount of, we'll call it, this conquest is not going to be a conquest of just any city, it's going to be the access for the rest of the land, which is what the Pesukim seem to be identifying for us as well. It's interesting today, and it's hard to visit all places of Jericho, it's a big tourist site, there's a lot of things to see there, there's a fascinating history, multiple levels of history. There's Elisha's spring is there, because Elisha purified the water, there's a lot of fascinating things going on in Jericho, but a number of the buildings are actually built into the mountainsides as well. So there's a beautiful monastery which is built into the sides of the mountains. It's on the one hand, it's near the mountains on the other, and the valleys on the other hand, it's near the coastal plain. It happens to be a very crucial military significant target. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted them to conquer the city, so why not a regular siege? A siege tower, some ballista, why this whole business walking around it, and the shofar, and the aron, and the kohanim, and the trumpets, and the... It seems like it's a bit of a strange ceremony. Why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu interested in this way? So the interesting thing is the Radak tells us in Source 3, he says, Ein lish ol tam lisiboy saibore lama ha'akpada ha'zois. He says, don't ask. It's very hard to understand, says the Radak. We don't really, you know, who are we to understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu really wants? However, there are a few suggestions that the Mevarash make, the Radak included. So as an example, Adon Yitzchak Abarbanel points out that it was in Source 2, Kedei La'arbev, it is to create confusion and chaos. Shekol Ha'evim Birosam Ha'esam Holchim Saviv Ha'ir V'lo Yechalacham V'lo Yariyu. So they're walking around. Can you imagine how unnerving it is? You have all the archers on the ramparts. You have everybody ready with their hot lead in their cauldrons, and the nation walks around at a safe distance, and they don't do anything. They don't shoot, and they don't attack, and they don't besiege, and they don't make even a noise for 6 days. It's uncanny. So everybody's getting very unnerved. So therefore, at the point v'kasher amze yiru hapal aniflo anaseh ba'achrona yedu v'yakiru ki yad Hashem ostazos. So then, on the seventh day, when everything falls down, they'll say this was clearly not a natural circumstance. This was not something which was to be expected as well. So Abarbanel says it's the lesson. Well, who's the audience? Audience is? Right. What? It's interesting. So it's a little ambiguous, but it sounds like the way he says is, V'kasher amze yiru. Amze yiru. So I believe that it could be referring to the nation of Jericho, the people of the city themselves, and those who are around them. So meaning to say, everybody else is going to say afterwards, whoa, this nation means business. They're not coming with regular military campaign. There's something wrong here. That's what's good. They're going to notice as this happens. The Radak says a very similar thing at the bottom in Source 3. Four lines from the bottom. It says, L'mayin yedu kol amei ha'aretz ki Hashem nilcham liYisrael la'becher v'la'bechanis. Hashem fights for this nation. It's not with sword. It's not with spear. Translate today. It's not with a great air force. It's not with great tanks. Yes, that as well. But it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who fights for this nation. And he says, by at the end, the Radak goes back and he says, U'mispar Hashiva, the seven, this business of sevens, right? There's seven rings, there's 7 days, there's seven kohanim, there's seven shofros. So there's this whole business. Yodua soda etzel mevinei meida. those of we'll call deep understanding, understand, know what's going on. Yavachain Shiva Mizbachois, the Shiva Parim, Shiva Elim, Vashviyo Anivchar, Bayamim Vachadoshim Vashanim. 7 is a very important number, and so therefore it has, we'll call it a Kabbalistic import. The Radak does not go on to explain what that is, but he says that there's obviously more going on over here than meets the eye as well. The Ralbag shifts the focus and he says, you know what? It's true that Hashem wants to unnerve and show a lesson here, but the recipients, the audience of this, is not not actually the Amei Haaretz. It is, as the top of the next page, he says, Zos HaTrua Gedola, Kedel SheYisoreru Yisrael, VeYakitzu Mishanas Tardei Masom, VeYidno Elibom Inyan Elu HaNifloos HaAtzumos. The Israel, like on the days of Elul and during Rosh Hashanah, one of the reasons why we blow the shofar is for us to wake up from our slumber and our, we'll call it our inertia in life. So that is the reason why we blow the shofar. We're blowing the shofar to wake us up. Forget the Jerichans. I'm not sure how we label them. There aren't as many today. So forget them. They were the byproduct. They were a separate. They were a vehicle. We were the recipient of this. Meaning to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is educating not them but us through this whole process. And therefore, it's very important because the tone is being set. There are going to be other military victories, and they're not going to be as miraculous. But understand that even when they don't seem as miraculous as this, understand Israel. Remember the shofar blast. Remember that I'm trying to wake you up from your slumber. That's the way the Ralbag understands it. Fascinating.
Why did it take 7 days?
Oh, so it comes back to the Radak says that there's a notion of 7. There's what's called the format of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what's called the completion of Teva, the completion of creation of the world is still there as well. It is interesting, coming back to Moshe's question, the Midrash Rabbah points out that what day did this all start on, right? So we're like, when did this all begin? Interestingly enough, the Midrash says that Im Yomar Lecha Adam Heach Chilel Yoshua Es HaShabbos. So how did he break Shabbos? Oh, so Hashem told him to do it because then he quotes the pasuk, which means, so therefore, according to the Medrash, what was the day constellation? When did this whole business start of starting to walk around Jericho? On Sunday. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, that's 6 days. And the seventh day of blowing the shofar, which is breaking Shabbos, right? That's is on the seventh day, which is Shabbos, which means, essentially, it's fascinating, it follows the same pattern as creation. Right, so there's 6 days and then the seventh day. And what's interesting is that as opposed to the creation where it seems that all the work's being done beforehand and then there's rest at the end, here it's the opposite, although it might be the same. Meaning it sounds like the work's done being done at the end, or really maybe that's not the case. Maybe the work is being done in the 6 days to get to the seventh day where all that energy of doing those circuits is actually coming to fruition over here. So there's clearly a notion that there's something deeply spiritual, like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge of it, like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge of creation of the world, he's in charge of the continuing creation of the world as it comes to, we'll call administration and management. You know, a lot of times we think, there are those who say, the Ramban points out, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we agree HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, but then he went fishing, right? He had other projects he was working on. So this sort of bridges the two. Hashem created the world and Hashem manages the world, right? Same operations. It's easier for us to say, well, we took care of the military and HaKadosh Baruch Hu took care of creation. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's involvement is constant, which is why the two patterns match up. The Chidah does point out, and he says an interesting insight, another thing which I never come across beforehand, he says in Source 5, he says, why do they do this, the circulation? Levatel kashafim hamazikim shenichu agoyim. He says that in the walls, the nations put all kinds of sorcery, all kinds of oracles, which were negative to the conquest. So what do they do? Is that by walking around, they were able to be mevatel that. They were neutralizing any of the forces that they were using on the dark side. Which is fascinating. What that means, how they did it, not sure. Never researched these topics about dark magic, but nonetheless. So this is undoing. So meaning to say, this is not actually part of the conquest. It's part of the neutralization necessary for the conquest itself. Fascinating as well. So you could also see this as not just a military buffer, but also a spiritual buffer that the nations set up for themselves as well. Okay. Now, so that's in terms of the actual circulation. Now the question becomes is, so why did Yoshua make a cherem, and did he actually have divine consent to make this cherem? Was there a reason why he was allowed to do this? Why was he making this city off limits? So there's three suggestions that the Medrash offers as to why he could have done this. The first one actually relates to what we just talked about, what Moshe just mentioned, and that is that it was on Shabbos. So it's seen as Shabbos is, in a certain sense, a bastion or a moment in time which is designated. This is seen as a moment in place which is designated. Fascinating, right? That's the sort of parallel, meaning to say, yes, there's going to be other days of action which are going to be other cities or conquests of Israel, but this is seen as the Shabbos of it, right? This is seen where we're sequestering, where we're setting aside. This is not going to be in our, we'll call it our ownership, our conquest. That's the way that the Midrash first suggests it. So it's seen as a Shabbos. What's fascinating is the Shabbos comes first in this instance. Shabbos is a fascinating thing in the sense that oftentimes we look at Shabbos as the end of the week, right? But Shabbos is also the beginning of the week, right? So Shabbos, on the one hand, receives energy of the week, but it also projects energy into the week as well. So to the degree, so let's say a person does not prepare for Shabbos and a person just arrives at Shabbos, you know, then obviously the Shabbos is not as special. But if a person utilizes Shabbos correctly as well, it also projects energy into the week as well. It's seen as sort of the Shabbos at the beginning of the week. It's the beginning of the 7 years of conquest. This is why he treats it unlike the rest of the conquest. That's one possibility the Medrash suggests. There's another possibility, and he says that it's considered an ir hanidachas. What's an ir hanidachas in Torah and Halacha? What exactly, how does it operate? So it's a city which is fully saturated with idol worship, to such a degree that it has to be absolutely destroyed, right? So it is seen as a place that is beyond fixing. It is so saturated, and unfortunately, when the Torah talks about it, it's talking about an Israelite city. It's talking about an Israelite city which was there were people who influenced it in such a way that the whole city area, Anoshim Vataf, everybody is serving Avodah Zarah. That city has to be destroyed completely, everything and everyone inside of it. Nothing be taken out of it. So the Midrash is saying that Yericho, in a certain sense, is that. Does that mean to say that it was worse than all the rest of the cities in Israel, all the Canaanite cities? Maybe not, or maybe it's the example of the rest of the cities. Hard to know exactly what the Midrash means over here. And finally, the last one is a fascinating suggestion, and that is, take a look at the in Source 7, five lines on the bottom, just the last one inside. It says, "Omar Rabbi Yudah Halevi Bar Shalom." So, Rabbi Yudah Halevi Bar Shalom, Halevi Bar Shalom says, "Limeid li Yisrael Mashi Omar Hakadosh Baruch Hu Reishis Arisoy Seichem Tachala Torimu Teruma." So he quotes a pasuk which is found in Parsha Shlach, which talks about the idea of giving chala. What does chala mean? How does it work usually? We mistranslate. We use the word chala to talk about our chalas. Right? And the chala means the amount you take off of the dough. Where does that go to? Goes to the kohen, right? So it's dedicated. So you take a little bit of dough and the rest of it's for you. It's a form of truma. So that being the case, so he says, Om Yoshua, hoyel the kavashnu, I saw tchila naktish es kol shalalot la gavoya. It's like he's taking off the challah, right? There's going to be more conquests to come. I'm dedicating to our Kodesh Baruch Hu what's going to go first, which is why the gold and silver and all the precious goes to the treasury. Everything else is burnt, right? This is sort of the challah experience, right? And everything else is now accessible for us. It's the Reishis HaGeiz, it's the Bechor, it's all the, so to speak, the ways of sorting. Yeah,
Eliezer. But I am the one who compares it to challah, right? Reishis HaGeiz and Bechor, I can understand, because that's the first. But challah, you have to have something left over. And here you're taking the whole thing.
It's a good question. That's true, but at the same time, the pasuk is quoted.
What we learned in Smicha Sachaveh, they did it on Shabbos, and so therefore, the machlokas of whether it's completely us or not, something that's built on Shabbos would be.
That's a good call, but the pasuk Eliezer that he's quoting is Reishis Adris Seichem. So you're correct. There are halachic parameters as to the size in order to necessitate it, but this is seen as an example of the first of your Adris Seichem, which is given as a trumus. So that's why it's sort of seen as this first dough where he's dedicating it. So now the question becomes: is okay? So we have these logics, right? So we have three different logics. Whether it be it's the Shabbos. Whether it be the Irani Dachas. Whether it be the Reishis Ariso Sechem. So did HaKadosh Baruch Hu say you should do this? We didn't hear that in the Psukim. Now the Torah and the Tanakh doesn't need to tell us every conversation that ever happened, right? There are many times where a prophet will say something. We know that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, but there are other times where it doesn't say that, and maybe it actually wasn't what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. What's the story in this case? So it's interesting that the Midrash actually says in source 8. This is the Midrash in Vayechi, Tanchuma, Ove Echad Bimei Yoshua, talking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu corroborating the words of a prophet, B'shosh Enitnos of Yisrael, Omerim Yoshua, V'ahoyza Ira Cherem, Hi V'chol HaSheba, V'enata Moitzah Shinistavu Alkach. We don't see the command for Yoshua to make the Cherem. El Yoshua Me'atzmoy Omar. So the Midrash says, this was his own volition, this is his own initiative that he took. Uminash Yiskim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Imohem, Shekach Ksiv, Chotel Yisrael V'gam Avru, So later on, when they're going to actually fail at the next war against Ha'ai, because somebody did take from the Cherem against Yoshua's wishes, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says because they sinned, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wouldn't have called it a sin if he didn't agree with Yoshua's policy, correct? So the fact that he calls it a sin indicates that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Yoshua, you're correct. This is the right moment to do it. By the way, this is a very complex business because these kind of decisions, are called very gray area. As an example, the first time the Torah says the word reach nichoach, a pleasant smell, pleasant aroma by a korban is by where? In which situation was there ever a reach nichoach?
Noach,
right? Noach walks out the teva, he brings the korbanos, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "Yarach Hashem is reach nichoach," and that's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "I'm not going to destroy humankind again," right? That's in Parshas Noach. Now, what's the definition of reach nichoach? Just interestingly enough, how is it defined based on Chazal when we get to Sefer Vayikra? The pleasant smell, HaKadosh Baruch Hu smelling. What does that mean? Hashem smelling. So, what does a pleasant aroma mean to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Rashi says at the beginning of Parshas Vayikra, "Shamarti v'nasis ritzoni." That I said something, I asked you to do something, and you listened to me. Right? So what's fascinating is, the first time in the Torah, where there's a reach nichoach, Hashem never told him to do it. Right? No, Hashem never told him to sacrifice any korbanos. What did Hashem tell Noach? What's the only thing which could be a clue in the right direction?
To take the extra kosher.
Right, so suddenly, right, there's seven goats, but there's only two camels. Right, so now Noach has been busy scratching his head for the last year. He has been feeding all these, we'll call domestic animals, with split hooves and that keep chewing their cud. He doesn't know why. And then after he comes out of the teva, everything's wiped out except for him and his family. At that point in time, he makes the connection and connects the dots and brings the korban. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "Vayarach Hashem es reach nichoach." Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "Omarti, I said it, but I didn't say it so explicitly. I was kind of waiting for you to make that connection." That's a little bit over here as well. There's times where Jewish leaders have to make this decision. Yoshua was not told to do this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you made the connection, right? These are hard things to do, to make those connections. Not always so obvious. Yoshua made that connection and is generally seen as a positive thing. However, not everybody agreed with this. So as is very clear, if you go into Perek Zion, what happens is, in Yoshua, is there is an individual who has the name of Achon. Achon actually doesn't listen to Yoshua. He takes some stuff, buries it under his tent, thinks nothing's going to happen. They go into the next battle against Ha'ai, and 36 people die in battle. Yoshua realizes something's wrong. He turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says the following words to him in source 10. Vayomer Hashem Yoshua, Kum lach, get up. Lama ze'ata nefel aponecha. Yoshua, get off the ground. Why are you prostrating yourself? What's the problem over here? So the Rashi says, that sounds a little harsh, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu said the tone that Hashem speaks to Yoshua sounds like it's a bit of an attack. Why is he saying this? So Rashi presents three possibilities. He says, Kumloch, he says, Omad l'chol mashvias v'alalta l'fonai v'izkarta. He says, get up and you just prayed. So now act, right? Number one. Dabar acher, Omad l'chol b'machane v'liyotzasi mohem. You didn't go to war with them. You're sure you should have been there with them. You shouldn't have sent just the army. Jewish leaders are supposed to lead the army, not lead from behind. Okay, and then finally, the last possibility, the davar acher on the last line is kol kumlach bishvilcha zois lahem lo yamarti lecha lahaktis shlal ha'ir. It's because of you, because you were the one who made the cherem in the first place. Which means that although HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as the Midrash in the Tanakh says, did agree to it, but there is a level of criticism on Yeshua. Why? Because you brought it upon them. Which means every time you make a policy comes with a cost. And part of the cost is, are people going to really listen to it? So what's fascinating is, you may say, statistically speaking, Yeshua has, arguably 3.2 million people here, right? So we have 600,000 men, 600,000 women, double that for children, at least, right? So we have 3.2 million people here. Yeshua makes a rule, and one family transgresses that. So you say, statistically speaking, that's pretty good, right? So we're gonna, if we're gonna make a new speed limit in town, right? and there's going to be, you know, a few offenders. We're going to lower the speed limit in, you know, on highways to 45. I'm not making any suggestions here, you know, but so everybody's going to listen. But then there's going to be, you know, a few offenders. Okay, so that's, you know, that's the byproduct of making rules, right? Whenever you regulate, there's going to be offenders. What statistic do you need for the, we'll call it breaking those rules, to invalidate the rules? It's a gzera shana yatzibur yecholim la'amod b'hem, right? How far does that have to go? So I don't know. As you know, anytime you make a regulation, there's going to be a certain amount of people who can't abide by it. What Hashem's saying to Yeshua, and this is a very sharp statement, is even one family is going to do something which causes them, God forbid, death. It's not worth the rule, right? That's part of the hidden, the veiled criticism in Kumlach, which is being said over here. That's a very sharp criticism. In fact, the fact that Achon himself took wasn't just because Achon, you know, was trying to get a new villa by the Riviera and he needed a little bit of extra money. So it was actually the Midrash was actually more ideological. Take a look in source 9. The Midrash Rabbah says, Amar Yoshev ani kach ha'yisi yodea shadavar toloi b'cha elo hagedno v'al tachachin. Many times he turns to Achon and he says, tell me why you did this. Amar loy v'oire b'shalol. I saw him in the spoils. Omar, what does that mean? Histakalti mashakosuba Torah v'achalto es shlalo vecha. The Torah tells us when you're going to conquer the land of Israel, you will enjoy the spoils of your enemies. And that's what the Torah does say. Default is when you conquer a city, you can actually benefit from the conquest of that city. So Achan says, Yoshua, I don't believe that you were correct in making such a chair. Now, it didn't help Achan because he still got killed, because Yeshua still made the law and HaKadosh Baruch Hu rabbi stamped that law. But there's a certain degree of, we'll call it, resistance, which Achan had ideologically, not just because it was an indulgence he couldn't hold back from. He felt that Yeshua was incorrect in making this, and to a certain degree he was held responsible. Yeshua as a leader was held responsible for this. So all the best intentions and all the most noble and spiritual ideas, there's still a cost. And that cost sometimes could be too high. Very, very hard to live this down, to understand this. Now, turns out that there is a fascinating description of how Yericho happens to be connected. But actually, we'll come back to the Talmud in just a moment. The third part component is, not only did Yeshua see this as, so to speak, this chala, this irani dachas, which needs to be, so to speak, completely set aside and not accessed, he makes the reference to there not being the future rebuilding of it. Why would he do that? Why would Yeshua make such a comment and such a shvua about this terrible curse on the rebuilding of Jericho? So the Rambam actually, ironically enough, at the very end of Moreh Nevuchim in Chelek Gimel Perek Nun, says the following: "V'lezeat ba'atzmo hechrim Yeshua in source 13, mi sheyivne Jericho la'olam liyos hamoyfes hahu kayam omeid." So it should be this we'll call it almost like a museum, a eternal remembrance. Anybody who would see that wall shekua ba'aretz, yisboer lo she'ein zeh tchunas binyan she'ne'eras aval nishka b'moifes. You walk past, and the tour buses go past Jericho, and they say, you see all those ruins, that pile of stone over there in the center? That was Hashem taking charge. That's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu operates. That's what was supposed to be done. It was supposed to be this eternal, we'll call it, memorial. And the two actually, therefore, says, if you think about what the Rambam is saying, go hand in hand. The Cherem and the Shavua are really two parts of the same whole. You're not supposed to benefit from the sitting, you're supposed to see it because you're supposed to remember that it was miraculous, which goes back to the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu ordered to be miraculous. Yeshua, in a certain sense, was extending HaKadosh Baruch Hu's miraculous introduction to the land by placing a Cherem and a Shavua on it. Now, sadly enough, in later history, it was rebuilt. It was rebuilt by a man by the name of Chiel in the times of Ahav, the king. It was seen as a very terrible thing. And, I mean, this is unfortunately very sad statement. It's one pasuk at the very, very end of here on the last page, where it says, "Biyomov bono chiel beis ha'eli." So there's a man from Beis El. Beis El was where one of the shrines of the northern kingdom was. There was a golden calf in Beis El. So Chiel came from the northern kingdom, from Beis El. He built Jericho. Ba'aviram b'chara yisda ufisaguv tzira hitziv delosel. When he put the foundations, his firstborn died. When he put the doors on, his last child died. Kidvar Hashem ashidibeh b'yad Yoshua binun. As Yeshua had said, so centuries later, somebody did do this, and he suffered the consequences of the curse, which actually did come to be. And you have to think to yourself, like, how apathetic, how indifferent, how What level of lacking of self-analysis does a person have to have? And this is the Chiel model is a very dangerous model to be seen. In fact, the next pasuk, does anybody know what the next pasuk in Tanakh is? This is the end of Perek Tezayin in Sefer Melachim Aleph. Does anybody know what the very next pasuk is after this? This is the next pasuk is the appearance of a man by the name of Eliyahu HaTishbi. And Eliyahu immediately declares a drought in the land. That drought is a function not only of the terrible things, like the corruption that goes on, the political corruption and immoral spiritual corruption in the times of Ahav. It's as a function of this being seen as a capstone of ignoring the past. When we forget the past, we forget what Hashem does to us in the past, says Eliyahu, then you don't deserve water. It's interesting that even when the water returns later on, the water of Yericho is bitter. It requires his student later on, Elisha, to fix that water many, many years later, decades later as well, when Elisha comes back and the first miracle he does is to purify the water of Yericho because it's still seen as that. The Tosefta does say that it was also to build Yericho, but once it's built, you can live in it, right? It's interesting. The Tosefta does say that people can, and Haraya for centuries. That's why the Arabs live there. It's one of the holy cities of Israel, right?
Live in the old city.
Jericho itself is as in Shechem, as in Hebron, as in all the holiest cities of Israel, which were resettled by Arabs over the century. This is one of the holy cities of Israel. One of the holiest cities in Israel is Jericho. An example of this is actually found in the Mishnayos in Maseches Tamid in the third perek. It's paid Dav Laman Amud Beis in Maseches Tamid. Fascinating topic. The topic is talking about the different moments in the day when bringing the Korban Tamid, how the day would roll out, and so there are certain indicators which were used in order for people to know when to do what. So the Mishnah then goes off on a tangent and says a fascinating description. It says, Mirichoi hayushamim kol shar agadol shenitach. So when they would open up the large gate of the Beis HaMikdash, you could hear it all the way to Jericho. It didn't oil it. No, what does that mean? Right? So it says, then Mirichoi hayushamim kol magrefa. From Yericho, they would hear the sound of the shovel. There was a type of shovel that was an instrument, really. They threw it on the floor, and it was almost like a cymbal, which would emit a sound to tell them about a specific change. So they could hear that from Jericho. Yericho, Yushamim, Kol Ashir. From Jericho, they could hear the song in the Beis HaMikdash. Yericho, Yushamim, Kol Ben Arza, Makish Betzalzal. And they could hear one of the families that was in charge of the cymbals in the Beis HaMikdash. Miricho Yushamim Kol HaChalil. They could hear the flute that was played in the Beis HaMikdash. Miricho Yushamim Kol Givinei Karuz. They could hear the announcements which were made. It was the person or the family of Givini who used to make the announcements. Miricho Yushamim Kol Eitz She'asa Ben Kotin Muchni Lekior. So they could hear the wood that the Ben Cotton family used for the pulleys of the wash basin to lower it into the well overnight. They could hear that winching it up. Miricho Yushamim Kol Ashir. They could hear the song. Miricho Yushamim Kol Shofar. They could hear the blast of the shofar. Yeshorim Av Kol Shel Kohen Gadol B'Shashu Machriz Mazkiras Hashem B'Yom HaKippurim. Even when the Kohen Gadol would mention the name of Hashem, which is when everybody would prostrate themselves like we reenact in Shul. From Jericho, they could smell even the smell of the Ketores. Fascinating. So you think to yourself, what does that mean? Jericho is many, many miles away from Jerusalem, right? So the smell, the sound, all these crucial moments, what's going on over here? Turns out that on the Gemara itself, there is a very beautiful rivet. Rav Avram Beistin says the following, he quotes, he is Moiri Arava Chosid. Not sure who that is. I did not quote it, they put it into sources. But he says the following, I'd like to read it just because it's so powerful. He says, Kol Hanach Kasani Yerichai. Why did it say that all these things could be heard in Jericho, from Jerusalem, in the base of Mikdash? Why was it so relevant? Because it was the beginning, because it was the first conquest into the land of Israel, it was like the Trum of Israel was Jericho when it was set aside to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he made it holy by dedicating it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is like Jerusalem. Jericho has an element of Jerusalem in it. For Yonishmaim ba kol hanach tekasani. That's why you could hear all these things there. Kedesh shiargishu b'nei Adam shebiricho yesh kamoi kein ksas kedusha kamo b'Yerushalayim. So that means to say, it sounds like you're even taking this literally, that there was a tradition you could hear these things in Jericho. Because the resonation, meaning to say, when you have something which is holy, it no longer abides by some of the laws of physics. Right? There was this connection between the Reishis Ari Soisechim of Jericho and Jerusalem. He goes on to further, Lefichach ba'ele yoyser mishar dvarim, and this is why these specific elements were heard. Bimnei shekol ele advarim kol shara godol tziltzal gvini korus heim tchilas avoras hamaamidim es hakohanim la'avoras ha'melevim edudukhanam v'akakatoris tchilas avoras panim v'day bahanach. And the Rav says that all of these services as described in the Mishnah are services which are the beginning of the day. Remember, Maseches Tamid is talking about the first korban in the day, and they talk about it as the sun rising, and then the announcement, and then the opening of the door, and they're throwing down the symbol. All these things are the beginning of the day. Why? Because Jericho is the beginning of the service. So all the beginning of the services go back to the beginning of the conquest, which goes to Jericho, which is what Yoshua is trying to do. Yoshua is trying to extend what Hashem was essentially showing him, right? Hashem said, this is going to be a miraculous conquest. Yoshua says, it's going to remain a miraculous conquest, which is why it was successfully so for many centuries as the first conquest. So folks, closing today with the first siege that we're going to be focusing on. I would be interested, anybody know what the next siege is that we're going to be talking about? We're going to learn together? All right, good question. Good attempt. I'm going to go a little earlier than that. We're actually going to do a Jewish siege, and this time it's going to be the siege of Jericho. It's going to be the siege of Jerusalem. Okay, so it turns out that conquering Yerushalayim was not so simple itself. There's a number of different attempted sieges. We're going to follow the sieges of Yerushalayim throughout the times of Yeshua, Shoftim, and Shmuel to focus on the conquest of Yerushalayim before we get to the other folks trying to go to besiege us on the outside. Yes, Moish.
Should it really be considered as a siege? I mean, it seems that they went around seven times, the walls miraculously fell down, nobody got hurt.
Yes.
Until this situation with Abiram, where 24 people were killed. But, I mean, is it a siege that, I mean, did you need an army?
Yeah, so it's a good question. It's a good question. So in this series, happens to be where I'm being a little flexible about the definition of siege, so I have that poetic license to put it into the series. But if it weren't for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it certainly would have been a siege. And that was part of the reason when Moshe Rabbeinu sent the spies into the land of Israel, one of the questions is, Hamabachanim im b'mitzarim, are they open or are they closed cities? And closed cities are much harder to conquer. So if they had not had HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention, this would have been a very long and arduous siege, which is why Yericho was so fortified.
Israel are not actually there at the time. It was closed up at the time. It was rough up. It's closed up now. They can't go in.
They're already locked to the key. They were considering a siege. It's true. Eliezer?
Maybe that's so good of a cigarette.
Correct.
They besieged themselves.
And the miraculous resolution was from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rabbi said, thank you very, very much for taking the time. Hi, yes. Yeah.